are listening to the cycling podcast De Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour,
the home of cycling with character.
Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run. Stage 4. Today we are in El Puch.
Welcome to Spain. My name's Lionel Burney. I'm with Daniel Freeb. Where are we, Daniel?
We're in Valencia. Amunt, Valencia. Do you know what that means?
No.
Nor do I. But Amunt is what I see this. Valencia football fans. I think it's some kind of catchphrase that has become a hashtag, a deplorable hashtag. But I think it just means come on, Valencia, in Valenciana dialect. Amunt. And do you know what's the story about the bats in Valencia? Well, the Valencia football team has their badge is a bat above the Valencia flag. But I haven't done my research on that. I should really know that. But we're in Valencia for a few days, so we will revisit that subject, bats and Valencia.
We will indeed. Well, we're on the outskirts of Valencia, really, just next door to the Luis Puig Velodrome, named after the former UCI president. He was president in the very late 80s for only a short period of time before Hein Verbruggen. But, Spanish, of course. He was also on a sort of big mover, big noise in the IOC for a while, and was instrumental behind bringing the World Championships to Benidorm in 1992. We were in Benidorm a few days ago, of course. That was when Gianni Bugno won. It was in Olympic year 92, so there was only really a professional men's road race, and there were really no takers for the World Championships that year, and Luis Puig pulled some strings and got the World Championships and Benidorm together. And well, Benidorm, what they got out of it was they got a load of their roads resurfaced, so win-win for everyone. Anyway, the Velodrome is just over there. The World Track Championships were held there in 92 as well. And the other big thing about Valencia, Daniel, is the paella, which we had last night. What was your verdict on your vegetarian paella?
It was good, it was decent, but we were in the province of Alicante, weren't we? We're now in Valencia, so hopefully, we're not in the most auspicious gastronomic destination, we're in the Trip Hotel, Northern Valencia. Trip was, I'm going to whisper it because we've got team personnel all around us. We're staying in the same hotel as Movistar and De Koenig, but Trip was a hotel chain favoured by Eufemiana Fuentes, the infamous doctor I know because I've seen some of his hotel receipts in police files. He often used to frequent the Trip Hotel chain.
Maybe he had a loyalty card, and then the riders had a Fuentes loyalty card as well, didn't they, for a decade or so?
Quite possible. But getting back to the paella, I'm foxed by this napalm because, well, what I've learned today is that the Valencian paella, which is the original paella, does indeed contain only meat, no fish. So rabbit and chicken. Originally, a couple of centuries ago, the main meat ingredient was marsh rat, apparently.
Wow, I wouldn't eat that, I'm afraid. We did have an excellent paella in this region a couple of years ago in the press room, which had rabbit in it. I think that might have been in Sagunto. I can't quite remember. Maybe it was certainly on this stretch of coast. The paella in the press room today was also very, very good.
Was there any lemon in evidence?
There was lemon. Is that a no-no as well?
Apparently, this is a big no-no. Apparently, in MasterChef in Spain, aired in Spain in May, there was a huge controversy because there was a contestant from Valencia who I think did very well in MasterChef. I don't watch TV generally, but I don't watch MasterChef. But I think he was highly sort of touted, this particular contestant from Valencia, and the judges were absolutely appalled that he served up a paella with a lemon in it, a lemon like decorated garnish with lemon, and they sort of said to him, well, what's wrong with it? There must be something wrong with the paella. You put lemon in the middle. You must be trying to hide something. You're very shifty.
TV's Daniel Freeb there admitting he doesn't watch TV. Absolutely. that's the Daniel Free playbook, really, isn't it? Well, my paella experience last night was slightly disappointing. I thought the rice was good, the chicken was good, but the seafood element, maybe I'm coming round to the idea that the meat and seafood shouldn't mix, because my langoustine was really disconcertingly translucent, and there was a big vein in the prawn, and I couldn't, unfortunately, I left both seafood elements on the side. But the paella in the press room was excellent. There were two variations, one traditional with chicken in, but I'm assuming Valencian, and the other one had chickpeas and black pudding in it, so right up my street. But this isn't the paella podcast, this is the cycling podcast, and in this episode we will be hearing from our excellent diarist James Knox of De Koenig Quickstep, who had a win today, and Nick Schultz of Mitchelton Scott. We'll also hear from Mitch Docker of EF Education First, and from Orla Chenoui from the cycling podcast Feminin and the Eurosport team, of course. But before that, let's recap stage four from Cuyera to El Puig. It was, well, I had a really tortured pun wordplay set up here. You're already wincing at this, Daniel, but we're no longer on the Costa Blanca. We've moved up a bit. Sam Bennett didn't win the stage, but I had a twisted version of the misquote from the film Casablanca, "Play it again, Sam," on the Costa Blanca. The quote didn't even appear in the film. It's a misquote. It's assumed that one of the characters says "Play it again, Sam" in Casablanca, great movie that you've not even watched, Daniel. Anyway, this is irrelevant, because Sam Bennett didn't win the stage. It was it was quite a siesta style day, wasn't it, for lots of it. Yellow Wales of Lotto Soudal and Jorge Cubero of Burgos BH broke clear. Cubero had a mechanical problem with 31 kilometres to go. Wale stayed out in front a little bit longer till 18 kilometres to go. And then the run into the town, Remy Cavagna of De Koenig Quickstep launched a very strong attack with about 5.5 kilometres to go.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that Cavagna's attack, which wasn't supposed to be an attack, he just rode too fast. He was supposed to be setting the pace. And I spoke to him at the finish, and he got himself a 50-metre gap, 100-metre gap, and at that point the director said, well, you might as well carry on now. he got it quite badly wrong, didn't he? But almost got it very, very right.
He did. This is another example of how the sports directors, they reverse fit their excuses, their tactics, their comments, because Wilfred Peters of De Koenig Quickstep didn't give me that impression at all. Anyway, Cavagna stayed clear until he was in touching distance of the kilometre to go banner, but then he was caught. On the final roundabout, the Irish champion, yesterday's winner, of course, Sam Bennett, went the long way round and gave himself quite a job to do. He lost ground, he lost his teammates, and in the finishing straight, he came up very, very fast. But the Dutch champion, Fabio Jakobsen, just a few days short of his 23rd birthday, held on to win by a couple of centimetres for De Koenig Quickstep. Bennett was second. Fernando Gaviria, who had a shocker yesterday, was third. Bennett takes over the lead in the points competition jersey. His fellow Irishman, Nicholas Roach, held the red jersey for another day. And the other significant stories today were there was a crash for Rigoberto Urán with about 57 kilometres to go, a touch of wheels and he went down. He was brought back by his teammates, required a bit of treatment at the medical car to his left wrist. The other big news concerning the GC riders is that Steven Kruiswijk is out of the race. He'd been suffering with a bad knee since Jumbo-Visma crashed in the team time trial on the opening day. He withdrew from the race, and I think, Daniel, you spoke to him at the finish, so I'll ask you what he said in a minute. And that's a blow for Jumbo-Visma, because tomorrow is the first summit finish of the race.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Thank you very much to Rafa. The Pedaleur de Charme prize will be awarded at the weekend. Keep your nominations coming. Just a word on what merits a Pedaleur de Charme nomination. We're not ruling out people who give bidons to young fans. That's very charming behaviour, but maybe if you see something a bit different to that, that would be good. So keep your nominations coming on Twitter at @cycling_podcast. And as ever, if you want to check out the Pedaleur de Charme range of clothing, t-shirts, jerseys and caps, go to rafa.cc. Now, yesterday, De Koenig Quickstep made a bit of a mess of things, didn't they? They had both Jakobsen and Max Richese in the top six, I think it was. Didn't work out for them. But today, they got it right. But did they get it right kind of by default because of Sam Bennett going the wrong way around the roundabout?
It looked that way, Lionel. Bennett was certainly as fast as he had been yesterday. It's interesting, isn't it, that these mistakes can still be made. I spoke to Bennett at the finish. He said, well, you know, on the book, it looked as though the roundabout was, well, it looked slightly different in the book, and that was why he made the mistake that he did. But usually what teams do now is they have people who go ahead of the race, a third director sportif or a soigneur who feeds back that kind of information. It sort of reminded me of what happened to Thibaut Pinot on the stage at Albi in the Tour de France, where you know, the infamous, the magic roundabout where they lost 40 positions. And again, there the riders had been told something about that particular roundabout, and it proved quite different when they got to it. But it was pretty costly, wasn't it? But, you know, sprints, winning sprints is about avoiding mistakes as well, isn't it? And that's what Jakobsen did.
He did. He's a talented rider, of course. He's a Dutch national champion, only 22 years of age, and apparently was disappointed yesterday not to get it right. At the finish, I spoke to both Max Richese and the De Koenig Quickstep sports director, Wilfred Peters. So let's hear first from Richese, the lead-out man and the road captain, really, very experienced rider, the Argentinian champion, of course, and then from Wilfred Peters. Yesterday, it didn't work out for Jakobsen, but today everything went perfectly?
Yes, today we did a really good job. In the final, it was not easy because the crosswind, a lot of corners, and we take the decision to stay in the front in the last case. And we did a perfect job with Remy before when he attacked, and after with the Stevie in the last K, and nothing. We did a really good lead out.
And are you happy for Jakobsen? Because yesterday he must have been disappointed.
Yes. Yesterday was really chaotic sprint, and for today we changed the tactic. We did the sprint in the front and we win.
Yesterday didn't go perfectly for Fabio, did it?
No, yesterday was more faster the last 5Ks, and it was too far behind. And I was like, okay, we have a little bit crosswind and roundabouts, 5K to go, and then we ask you to Remy Cavagna for speed it up there. Okay, see, let him go. And on the end, we were happy, and somebody else needed to pull. Yeah, and on the last bridge, that was important for us also, that we need Stibar. And okay, one guy of Sunweb coming over, that was the best situation. Then Richese can go on 400 meters. Okay, you saw Bennett come from behind very fast. And okay, we won with 2 centimeters, and is enough.
2 centimeters is enough. You've seen a lot of very, very good sprinters in this team, but how does it feel when a young guy riding his first Grand Tour gets a victory like this?
This is very important, I think, for support him and also for the motivation. I think a guy like him in a big tour, I think, is more important. I think the first week is important one. I think after the climbs, the next 3 stages is very hard for him, and he suffered a lot. Okay, the weather was better for him today, not 40 degrees, and I think we can continue like this on this level.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast, team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of our Vuelta coverage is sponsored by Roka sunglasses. Roka were founded in 2013 in a garage in Austin, Texas, with the mission to create the world's finest eyewear. And 6 years and 30 plus patents later, Roka athletes have won numerous world titles and stages of the Tour de France. And one of the favourites for this Vuelta, Miguel Angel Lopez, also wears Roka sunglasses. Now, the model he chooses to wear is the really eye-catching CP1X, and it's a model of glasses that I managed to try out in between the Tour de France and the Vuelta. They're quite a large frame, and they wrap around the front of my face. They could almost have been designed specifically for the contours of my face, and that apparently is not an accident. They also have bendy arms, which means that you can mould them to fit you specifically. And, well, I tried them with a couple of different cycling helmets, and they fitted equally well with both of them. But the thing that struck me most about them was that even though they fit close and they're quite enclosed, you can't really feel them. And the most crucial thing was they didn't fog up. Now, if you ride in Britain in the summer, you'll be familiar with these circumstances when it's a very warm day and then you get a rain shower, and normally the first thing that happens is that the glasses fog up, but the Roka CP1X glasses just didn't do that. And well, that was something that was noticeable for me. If you would like to check out the full Roka range, which they describe as the lightest, most advanced eyewear in the peloton, go to roka.com/vuelta and you can get 20% off your order. That's roka.com/vuelta and you can get 20% off the price. Well, we're in the De Koenig Quickstep Hotel, Daniel. No sign of obvious celebrations yet, but I'm sure they'll have a beer with their dinner. Let's hear from our diarist, James Knox, who was part of the De Koenig Quickstep team. Of course, he's not really involved in lead outs. That's not his job here. Nevertheless, he has tasted the winning feeling this evening. So first, let's hear from James Knox. And secondly, from our other diarist, Nick Schultz of Mitchelton Scott, who answers some of your questions. Now, both James and Nick are happy to answer any questions you've got about the Vuelta or cycling in general. Check out our Twitter feed at @cycling_podcast or search for James Knox or Nick Schultz on Twitter and post your questions. And over the coming days, if they have quiet days on the race and don't have anything particular to report, they will answer some of your questions. But here they are, our Vuelta diarists, James Knox and Nick Schultz.
Another stage down, and obviously the result we're after. Very, very good day in the end with Fabio taking the win. And I think more importantly, well, I think everyone did their jobs perfectly. I think, you know, great atmosphere on the bus afterwards. Everyone's buzzing. We're going to enjoy a nice beer at the dinner table tonight. I think Tim rode like a horse all day on the front, and then the late attack from Cavagna really put the other teams under pressure. And then Stevie, Max stayed together and put Fabio into the perfect position to sprint for the win. And yeah, Fabio finish off even though it was less than a tire width, I think, in the end. So no, we're all really dead sure for that today. That was perfect. Other than that, my day, I had a little bit of a crash, 50k in, I think, just flipped over the bars. Well, there was already some people on the floor, and then I had nowhere to go. It was across like a little center part in single file road, and the whole road was blocked by some guys on the deck, and I just sort of bounced over the top and landed on bodies. So I was pretty lucky to come away without anything. My mum and dad now have been here couple of days, so I've been catching up with them before and after the stages. They've been pottering about. I think they went to have a look at Valencia instead of going to the finish today, so they're here for up until the first rest day, I think, almost. So yeah, it's nice having them here. I don't see them an awful lot, so try and catch up with them as much as possible. I guess as well, that's my first victory in a Grand Tour as part of the team, which is a big deal actually. Shouldn't take that for granted. I guess with this team, things like that, you do start to take them for granted. Happens a bit too much, all the success. But no, it's really, really nice. Yeah, lucky situation to be in with how well it's going in the team. I guess if I'm being honest, there's a certain amount of pressure on our shoulders to perform, get results in the Giro. Saw the other side of that where, you know, things didn't quite go as planned. It was hard because, you know, for the top guys in our team, there is, you know, they're getting hounded, I guess, by media. Well, and also they get paid to win as well, and our team sort of semi-expects it a bit. So it's a huge weight off the shoulders. I think the Vuelta has just become a little bit nicer today. You know, we can, whatever happens now, we've got a stage win under the belt. We can keep now going for victories without that little extra stress. Yeah, savour this today and enjoy the rest of it.
Okay, stage 4, all done and dusted. Straightforward day. With a lot of luck on our side in regards to the weather. We got a little storm come over while we were starting the main climb of the day, but the descent was all dry, which was good. And the technical run-in with God knows how many roundabouts was also dry, so that made things a lot less stressful. Moving on, we've had a few questions come in that I'll respond to. There's one from Bob, who asked what it's like not having the Yates brothers riding in a Grand Tour. From a personal level, that's difficult for me to answer, as I haven't been a part of this team at a Grand Tour that they've been at. But I'd imagine it's not too much different, to be honest. We're here with a leader and a clear objective, and we ride to that objective. So I think it would be more or less the same with or without them at more or less all the Grand Tours now, as that's the direction that this team is taking. There's another one here from Gareth, who is asking if we have a target weight before we come to the Vuelta, or if it's a consistent weight all year. I think that probably varies amongst riders. I personally like to keep things pretty controlled throughout the year, pretty stable. But of course, coming into a Grand Tour, you don't really want to come in overweight at all. So for sure, you stay pretty focused in the weeks leading up to it, to make sure your weight is under control. For myself, I like to try and be around 66 kilos for important races. There's one here from Dan in regards to data. So yeah, there's a lot of data in cycling now: power meters, heart rate, probably plenty of other numbers that I'm not aware of. But I think it's a good thing for fans to interact with. I'm all for it. I keep all my rides on Strava so that the people who are interested can check in and see what the stages are like, what training is like. Certainly helps me improve and forms a main basis of my training. So yeah, for sure, I'm pretty reliant upon power in training, but not at all in racing. I don't look at it while I'm racing, and I don't analyze it on a day-to-day basis. That's for my coach to do, and I guess if anything's necessary to communicate with me, he'll do so. So yeah, if anyone else has any other questions or ideas or things you'd like to hear about on the daily, or what's happening in the peloton, just let us know, and I'll answer them as best as I can. Cheers.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Science in Sport have recently launched their Plant 20 range, which is an all-natural vegan approach to on-the-go protein, which is also low in sugar. Packed with protein, a key nutrient in the growth and maintenance of lean muscle mass, Science in Sport's great-tasting range is ideal as a snack or as a way of topping up protein intake throughout the day. Check out the Plant 20 range of bars and powders at scienceinsport.com. So, Daniel, the big loss for Jumbo-Visma is Steven Kruiswijk, who was on the podium at the Tour de France, of course, and was coming here to support Primoz Roglic, banged his knee in the team time trial when they crashed, and hasn't really been right since, it seems. Lost time on stage two, a minute and 43 seconds, I think it was, because he couldn't hold the pace on that final climb. Now out of the race, a blow for Jumbo-Visma, that.
Yeah, it is a big blow for Jumbo-Visma, and you know, even if you assume that Kruiswijk wouldn't have been in the shake-up for general classification, his hopes sort of faded in the first 2 days, then you know, you would have imagined and hoped, if you're a Jumbo-Visma fan, that he would have been very useful for Primoz Roglic in the second half of the race, particularly thinking back to the Giro, when we talked so much about how Roglic had maybe lacked support in the mountains. Remember, they had Antoine Tolhoek, Sepp Kuss and Kern Bauman as his mountain domestiques, having been deprived of Robert Haesink before the race. Here he has got Haesink, who is going to be very useful. He's also got George Bennett, and he's got Sepp Kuss again. So he's relatively well supported, but obviously Kruiswijk would have been another weapon for Jumbo-Visma. Kruiswijk himself was disappointed, obviously. I think less disappointed than he would have been, for example, if this had happened in the Tour de France, because really what he did after the Tour de France, he took a week off, and then he did about 10 days of very hard training, did a lot of climbing. And it wasn't a huge body of work that had gone into this that's now been compromised, but he just said that the knee wasn't really getting any better. He needs to go and have more checks and more tests on it. didn't know yet whether his season is over, but I would suggest that is likely to be the case now.
The other GC rider who had a tricky day, although not as tricky as Kralsvik, of course, was Rigoberto Urán, lying third this morning, 8 seconds behind Nicholas Roach, 6 seconds behind Nairo Quintana. He hit the deck, and, well, I spoke to his EF Education First teammate, Mitch Docker, at the finish, and he took full responsibility for that crash. First of all, Mitch, talk me through the crash. What actually happened?
It was just a touch of wheels. Actually, it was my fault. Just the wheel. I just happened to look down for a second. The next time I looked up, there was a wheel, and I was on the wrong side of the wheel. And, yeah, actually, I feel pretty terrible because Rigo was following me around and just crashed one of those things. Like, I didn't mean it, obviously, and crossed the wheels, and I went down.
Is he okay, though? Are you okay?
I haven't spoken to him, but, yeah, you're never that good when you go to the ground.
I mean, it's an occupational hazard, isn't it? If you're working for a team leader, you know, there's always a chance. You've got to keep so close together, I guess.
Yeah, look, you just want to install that faith and that trust. And, you know, something like that today damages that. So I hope we can just move on.
But then in the last 15 kilometres, you're up the front, keeping the pace high. Was that just to give the best chance of not getting caught out again?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we were never trying to split it there because I didn't think the wind was strong enough. But just coming into those towns and things, and we knew there was a lot of roundabouts, it was just better to be on the front foot.
I felt for Mitch Docker there because, obviously, you know, the point he made was that the team leaders trust their domestiques, and a touch of wheels means that a little bit of that trust sort of gets chipped away. And Docker, I think, very, very upbeat character, but probably feeling a bit miserable about that this evening. But we shall have to see how badly bashed up Urán was. And we'll find out tomorrow, of course, because there's a summit finish. It's the two Colombians, Quintana and Urán, who are most likely to take over the red jersey if Nicholas Roach falters. But then, you know, looking a bit further down, Mikel Nieve at 22 seconds, Miguel Angel Lopez at 33 and Roglic at 35.
Superman.
Yes, Daniel Superman. He's maybe we should ration the Superman mention. No, one per podcast.
No, I don't think so. Superman gave us a slip in the mix zone tonight. He often does that, actually. I do feel sorry for riders. There are, and particularly riders who tend to take the lead or be leading the young riders competitions in stage in 3 week stage races. You know, Lopez has had a 2 or 3 years now where he's often taking the lead pretty early, and it means he has to come to the mix zone every day, and he has to, well, he loses about 15 or 20 minutes giving us lot interviews in the mix zone. It happens with Sagan at the Tour de France, and Sagan is bored of the mix zone. The mix zone is kind of bored of Sagan. Every day he has to come because he's in the green jersey more often than not. So yeah, the poor old Superman.
You need to think of better questions then. I mean, why not fire some real random quiz questions at him?
What would be a good question?
That is a good question. What would be a good question for Superman in the mix zone tomorrow? So make your suggestions at @cycling_podcast on Twitter, and Daniel will definitely ask the most embarrassing ones. Now, just a slight change of mood here, because one of the riders in the two-man break today was Yella Wales of the Lotto Soudal team, and they've had a very traumatic month because their young teammate Bjorg Lambrek died after a crash at the Tour of Poland earlier this month. And Lambrek would have ridden this welter, and really the impact of that incident has taken a toll on the Lotto Soudal team. And a couple of mornings ago I spoke to Mark Sargent, the team boss, just really to pass on my condolences, really, and he talked about how difficult it had been for everybody in the team to cope with the loss of Lambrek, not just because he was you know, a young rider and such a talent, but because he was so popular within the team. And he said that the rest of the year, really, he's given all of the riders the freedom to make choices for themselves depending on how they feel as they come to terms with the aftermath of that incident. And two riders in particular, Thijs Benoot and Jasper de Boost were supposed to be riding the Binkbank Tour, very big race for Lotto Soudal, because half of it takes place in Belgium and the other half in Netherlands, but they wanted to go to Lambrecht's funeral and so asked if they could be swapped out of the team and volunteered to ride the Tour of Denmark instead, and they both won stages in the Tour of Denmark, which kind of just shows you, and Sargeant was talking about how the sport goes on, life goes on, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it's very difficult, and the riders in this race are still coping with the loss that they have suffered. But Wallace did a fantastic job, a tribute to his fallen teammate, just as Sander Armé did a couple of days ago. Now, Daniel, Sam Bennett, there's been a lot of discussion about the future of Sam Bennett. He's been with Bora Hansgrohe for a while now, and very disappointed at the start of the year. I mean, the disappointment was palpable in your interview with him when he knew from very early in the year at the team's training camp that he wouldn't be riding the Giro d'Italia, and I think you were quite surprised about how outspoken he was about the team's policy not to pick him for the Giro, because he would have known that he wouldn't ride the Tour de France either.
Yeah, and at that point I think we and he worried that he might miss out on all of the Grand Tours. That seemed to be the vibe. It wasn't, well, it didn't turn out to be the case here at the Vuelta, but I think he's proven this year that he deserves to be the Tour de France. We don't know, we mentioned last night, didn't we? We're sort of waiting for him to reveal where he's going to be riding next year. We think it's going to be De Koning Quickstep, and I'm sure he'll do really well there.
Well, earlier on today I went to see Ola Shenoui, who's working here for Eurosport. Of course, if you're watching the race at home on Eurosport live, you'll see Ola Shenoui hosting the coverage. She's one of the hosts of the Cycling Podcast Feminin, of course. Irish, as am I, as are you, Daniel. So it's been a big few days for us with Nicholas Roach in the red jersey and Sam Bennett now in the green jersey. I mean, how apt is that?
I'm very emotional, so I am.
Was that a Sean Kelly impression? Goodness me. Well, yeah, I asked Ola how this kind of resonates as an Irish person and in the media back in Ireland too. Well, I'm with Ola Shenoui down at the finish line. Yeah, it was a big day for the Irish yesterday, Ola. How did you cope?
Ole, 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 ole. Ole, ole. Stop me when you like. Ole. I'm sure that's an international, I know it's an international reference, but that's basically our anthem from Italia 1990, so I'm going to go with that. How did I cope? It was brilliant. It was awesome. So we had Nico Roach on the day before on Eurosport when he went into red, and then we had Sam Bennett on yesterday. And I don't know, I'm not a massive fan, to be honest, of patriotism in sport like cycling. It's such an individual sport, and they're not doing it to represent a country, really. But I couldn't help but feel really, really proudly Irish, you know, and I just couldn't help but feel just really happy that they'd done it. And coming from such a small country and thinking of all the kids growing up in Ireland, he'll see that and see that then as a target that they can aim for. It's just so inspirational, and it becomes aspirational, and it was just wonderful. And seeing the two of them together and with their arms around each other at the end, and Nico with his arm around Sam in the Irish jersey, I don't know, it's just really cute. I just wanted to put them on my mantelpiece. It was just lovely. I loved it.
It's like Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach all over again. I wonder what impact it will have back in Ireland. I mean, you know, Dan Martin, Nicholas Roach, Sam Bennett, there have been quite a lot of success in the last decade. I wonder what impact it's having back home.
Well, it's a funny thing, because I do think the Irish media tend to pick up an awful lot on the doping stories, and maybe not so much on the success. When Nico rode into red, there was barely an article in the papers back home, which I find really sad. I didn't check today, I haven't had time. I'm hoping there's been more of a fuss about the two of them together. But I think, you know, obviously within cycling communities, it'll have a massive impact. Although it was funny chatting to Sam yesterday, I said, you know, who were your heroes growing up? And he said, well, I should say Sean Kelly, but he was just a sports centre to me when I was a boy. So, you know, how much of that actually then gets through on the ground? It will do these days, obviously, because media is totally different. But I think the key really would be if the papers start to embrace this as a story, and media starts to embrace it as a story, and lose, I think, some of the natural and understandable suspicion and negativity that is associated with cycling in Ireland, not cycling in Ireland, but it just seems to be a particularly Irish thing. I don't know why, but...
I do wonder whether it's because the Festina affair broke when the Tour de France was in Dublin. I know that that was in 1998. It's a long time ago now, but that really kind of... that really damaged cycling in Ireland, I think.
It did, and I think it's no coincidence that two of the prominent journalists who've been chasing down anti-doping stories, David Walsh and Paul Kimmage, both being Irish, I think they are seen as champions of clean sport then back in Ireland, and maybe the little guys taking it to the big guys and showing them that they will find them out kind of thing. So I think that's been sort of taken on as a national cause, and I know that they're on national radio a lot and RTE and whatnot. So I think, yeah, you're probably right. It probably does stem back to Festina. These things take a long time to go away, and it takes a long time to change the national psyche. I do think the likes of Nico, with the heritage that he has, the likes of Sam, the cute little face, and, you know, he just comes across as so innocent, you know, and I think... that's a ridiculous statement to make in cycling. I mean this in a very, very superficial sense, but and I mean it to a general public, you know, viewing from the outside, who may be not so interested in cycling and don't maybe understand the background to it. I think those are the kinds of people who will pierce through that sort of psyche a little bit. I hope so.
He's done brilliantly this year, Sam Bennett, hasn't he? When you think back to Daniel's conversation with him at the Bora Hansgrohe training camp at the start of the year, where he couldn't hide his real disappointment at having been told very early that he wouldn't be doing the Giro d'Italia, which he'd done so well in, winning three stages last year. And even though it wasn't confirmed he wouldn't do the Tour, with Peter Sagan on the team, it was always very unlikely that he'd get in there. He's had to wait a long time for a Grand Tour this year, and you can't ask for more than win the first stage that suits his talents.
And to be one of the most successful bike riders in the world this year. He's had, what, 10 Grand Tour, World Tour wins. This is his 12th win yesterday. Only Julian Alaphilippe had more wins than him coming into the Vuelta. So, you know, he's kept his head down, he's kept his nose clean, and he's worked really hard, and is on course to be the most successful sprinter of the year, which is phenomenal, given that he didn't have a Grand Tour spot until the Vuelta. What's really hard, and we wait to see what's going to happen, but I got whispers of a case overnight that's ongoing between Sam Bennett and Bora Hansgrohe. Sam is desperate to leave the team, but Bora are trying to force him to stay on for next year, even though no contract has yet been signed.
But there's no precedent or legal framework to force Sam Bennett to stay at Bora Hansgrohe, and De Koenig Quickstep are pretty much of the opinion that it's just waiting to be done. They're just waiting for the opportunity to sign the contract.
And that is the best case scenario for Sam Bennett, that there is a team there waiting in the wings to take him whenever it is all resolved. But it's a legal case, so that has to be resolved before he's allowed to speak to other teams yet. I understand it was maybe something at the start of the year, maybe an offer that was made on condition of something or other, that I don't know the full details of it. But there's clearly some legal basis for Bora being able to take a case against Sam Bennett. But he's hopeful that he'll be able to extricate himself from that, because he hasn't yet signed any contract for next year. And like I say, the best thing for him, because we're late in the season, teams will be filling their rosters, especially with sprinters, but I guess with all calibre of riders, is that there is a team waiting to take him when it is all resolved. Because otherwise, this drags on and on. Everyone's books are full, and he's got nowhere to go other than to stay with Bora. Maybe that's what they're hoping for.
I think if nothing's signed and there's nothing in writing, a good agent will get him out of that. Well, it's interesting there, Daniel, because Ola clearly has a bit of intelligence about this wrangle with Bora Hansgrohe, supposedly an extension had been agreed but not signed, and there's now maybe a bit of a tug of love over Bennett. But I was talking off the record to some De Koenig Quickstep people today, and, well, they think that it's more or less a done deal. They've just got to get the lid off the pen and sign the contract. But who knows? I mean, De Koenig Quickstep have won today with another young sprinter, but they do have a sprinting gap with Viviani going. So who knows? But my money would be on Bennett going to De Koenig Quickstep and this all getting sorted out.
Yeah, I think so. Another fact to consider, Lionel, is that De Koenig Quickstep are on specialised bikes, and he's been on specialised bikes this year. I actually spoke to Sam Bennett at the start of the year about that, and you know, how important the bike technology is, particularly for sprinters. And, you know, he felt at the start of the year that he was already on the fastest bike in the peloton, and if he's on a specialised next year, he'll presumably feel the same again.
Well, do you remember when Mark Cavendish made that fairly oblique comment about not being able to compete because he didn't, you know, the bike wasn't quite, you know, and all the riders he mentioned that he couldn't compete with were on specialised bikes, so clearly there is something in that. Well, the sprinters won't need to worry about the bikes they're on tomorrow because we finish up at Javalambre. Not a climb I know. Not a climb that many of the riders know because the Vuelta's not been there before.
Correct, Lionel. The Vuelta's never been to the Alto de Javalambre. I'm quite intrigued by it. There's a theme park, I think at the bottom, some kind of theme park or sort of visitor centre called Galactico at the bottom of the climb. Galactico, of course, was a... There was a word used in Spanish in connection with the, in association with the Real Madrid team, the football team, with a lot of football references with the Buffalo not here.
Is it like Madame Two Swords, but for Real Madrid? There'll be like a Zidane waxwork and a Figo waxwork.
I think it's to do with astronomy, but...
it is an observatory up there, isn't it?
There is, but anyway, the Galactico theme park, Galactico's, well, as far as Real Madrid were concerned, being the sort of world star, the kind of absolute, you know, stellar names that Florentino Perez, the Madrid president, was absolutely determined to sign every year.
Well, who will be the Galactico tomorrow night? Who will be in red? I hate these kind of predictions, speculation, guesswork, but what do you reckon?
I think it'll either be Superman or Nairo Man.
Okay, well, Daniel Mann, before we go, let's say thank you to some of our friends of the podcast who have supported us by signing up to listen to our collection of special episodes, starting with our Grand Tour Diaries from last year. And the most recent one is a lunch with chat that I had with Jonathan Vauters during the Tour de France. And we're very grateful to all of our friends of the podcast for your support, but we are going to mention a few people this evening. Thank you very much to Matthew Brown, Karen Pollock, Neil Aitken, Sam Cooper, Christopher Metcalf and Lewis Morrison,
and to Ian Simpson, Andy South, Gordon McBain, James Hughes, Keith Warner and Michael Miss Kelly.
And thank you very much, Daniel. Unfortunately, we forgot to get the really difficult, tricky English names. We need some kind of Yorkshire name that is pronounced completely differently to how it's spelled, just to fox you.
Well, I got pulled up by someone. I won't go into detail on this, but it's a very sore subject. I got pulled up by someone about Tadej Pogacar today, the Slovenian prodigy who won the Tour of the Algarve, Tour of California.
This is great for me because there's nothing better than the squeaky clean getting done by the pronunciation police.
No, I wasn't impressed with that. And I was explaining to some of the members of the staff at UAE Emirates, Pogacar's team yesterday, that his first name, Tadej, is basically pronounced like today in a Cockney accent. Tadej.
That's more Aussie. That's more today in an Aussie accent, I'd say.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oh, 3 points on your pronunciation licence today, Daniel. Excellent news. Only 9 more points and a 2-day ban, I think, maybe. Anyway, hopefully not tomorrow.
Tedious. Very tedious.
We need you tomorrow up on that mountain.